You are listening to Irish Radio Canada at Home and Abroad. It's Tás Moran by Conscienish Le Podico Keja as Connemara. You're listening to Irish Radio Canada at Home and Abroad, and I'm delighted to be able to have a chat here with Padraig O'Keja from Connemara. Padraig is an interesting person with a varied, eclectic background, put his finger on the pulse of a lot of things in Irish life, and has been a great influencer, an entrepreneur, is involved with the University of Galway, was a teacher, solicitor, accountant, owner of an airline, also retirement homes, an Irish senator, and now an author. And one of the reasons we're connecting up is because Padraig's new book, The Purposeful Decision Maker, is about to hit the shelves here in North America. Padraig, tá fáilte rás?
Go to Mira Margaret to Austin, I guess. Asked me a couple of fucking tests and the third tour, I guess. Tasula don't come on in the history. Something is ten of us in Cora. Thank you so much, Austin. It's a huge privilege to be connected with you and to be connected with all your listeners all over Canada and in North America, I suppose, to a degree as well. So, Gormila Mahagat, I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
You are a native Irish speaker and English is your second language. So when you went to school and you had to relearn and adapt.
Yeah, that was a challenge. But Austin, I didn't know any different at the time. And you can imagine as a kid when you're growing up in East Galway or West Galway or any part of Ireland, all you know about the world is what's around you. And I went to the national school in Spittal. It was all Irish all the time. And then there was a few two friends of mine who were going to a Jesuit school in Galway City called the Jes in Sea Road in Galway. They were telling me, come on, let's go in. You should go to school. It's great crack on the bus. You're into town every day. And at that time, Austin, like my parents never went to secondary school. So schooling was not a big thing for them, quite frankly. Two things they wanted us to know as kids and as a family. One was integrity and the other one was to work hard. And that was a basic guideline, I think, for most of us growing up in the 50s and 60s and so on, and in Ireland in particular. When I said, can I go to this school? And they said, sound, if you want to go there, go there. Do we have to pay for the bus rent? And I said, no, I think the bus is free. So I went in there and I remember early on in an English class and the teacher asked me some question and I had a clue what he was saying. And I didn't want to look more stupid than I was. So I answered to what the question to what I thought he asked. And I'll never forget what he said. He says, young man, that was a great answer, but to a question I didn't ask. I thought I would be in serious trouble at the break time. But no, in fairness, the students were very sound and very nice. But I played a lot of sports. I played rugby for the school and hurling and football and so on. So I was very quickly kind of accepted in as part of the group. And I appreciated that. And overall, the teachers were very good to me as well and pretty flexible. So I got an amazing education with the Jesuits in Galway. And certainly it was a very big part of my foundation in relation to going into my teenage and young adult years and so on.
You have some ambition at this stage.
The ambition I had after Intercert in our time was to be an electrician. And my parents were okay with that. But the headmaster wanted to meet my parents and met them. I wanted my parents to get me to go and do the Leaving Cert. And I went and I did the Leaving Cert. And then the subject I enjoyed most, or probably more importantly, the best teacher I enjoyed teaching me was an amazing man called Michael Holland. And he was our commerce and business teacher. So I decided to study commerce in university in Galway. So I did a BCom. I had great crack in university. I really enjoyed it. There was accountancy firms going around Austin, going around the university, interviewing students to be trainee accountants. I didn't think about it at all. But there's a friend of mine who said to me, Jesus, go ahead and go in for the interview. There's a gap. Somebody didn't turn up in an hour's time. And I said, sure, I don't have a suit. He said, I'll give you my suit. I said, sound. So I put on a suit. In I go. I was a substitute interviewee. And the two fellows who were interviewing me from KPMG looked at each other. And they said to me, have we seen that suit before? You have. And the sleeves of it were all up about 6 inches. I was about 3 or 4 inches taller than your man, so the suit was too small for me. Honest to goodness, maybe because of my honesty or whatever, I ended up getting a job with KPMG. So I was a trainee accountant for a while, and that was all right. And then I moved to Galway, and Do you know, Austin, I'm sure listeners and you kind of think about this and you'd say, and I was only 23, 24 at the time, do I really want to do this for the rest of my life? Because I knew a bit about accountancy and the thing, and you're dealing with numbers and figures and all of that. One Saturday morning, I bumped into my old headmaster, great man called Father Ter, and he said to me, what are you doing? I said, I'm doing accountancy with a firm of accountants. I do earmark to be a teacher. I said, Jesus. He said, if you go back and do your H-Dip to be a teacher in the university in Galway, you can do your H-Dip in the Jesuit school, in the school that you're a student in. At the time, I was going out with this lovely girl, and her two sisters were teachers. So I said, Jesus, like I might get inside the front door of the parents' house if I was a teacher. I said, wow, why not? And the great thing about teaching, you've June, July and August off and a couple of more weeks during the year. So I left accountancy and I went teaching and I got a full-time job in the Jes. And some of the teachers who were there were teaching me and I loved it. And I started off, Austin, tried to model myself on Michael Holland, the best teacher, because he was teaching with me. And then after a while, after about 2 years, I decided, Porrick, if you try and be like somebody else, it really doesn't work. You got to be yourself. You know, Austin, just who you are as a person. That's so important. And that stood with me for the rest of my life after. But I learned that lesson early on when I was teaching. And then I wanted to be the best teacher I could be. Not to be better than Michael Holland or anyone else. You might ask yourself too at home or in the car, how can I be the best version of myself? So I started to figure out how to be a great teacher. For me, what's great for me? So I started learning about teaching and how people learn. And I went to England, I went to America to do courses during my summer holidays at my own cost. And a penny dropped. Porrick, teaching is the wrong term. Teaching, it's not about teaching. Teaching is instructing, telling people what to do. Your role is different. It's to facilitate learning. So what I was doing, Austin, I would go into the class and I'd create the environment within which students felt comfortable, relaxed, minimum stress, and would dive into this swimming pool of learning. And when they would see they could actually go and do it, yeah, I can do it. And this person's got belief and faith in me. Then they started performing. And then I used to get them to write their own Leaving Cert Maths book. And this is 35 years ago or more. I used to start getting them to do mindfulness at the beginning of the class, just to calm down a little bit. Now, mindfulness as such wasn't invented at the time, but it used to be part of some of the courses I did in the States and in England. So I said, yeah, this is interesting. And then I decided to take a career break. And I was teaching for probably 8 or 9 years. And I'm also a solicitor as well as an accountant. So I said, Jesus, I'll set up a law practice for the crack. So I set up a law practice in Galway because we didn't have any money. And I was married at that time to that girl I wanted to show up to, because two of our sisters were teachers, because we were still married 40 years on, and it's the best thing that ever happened to me in my life, and I was so lucky. I was going to say it's the best decision I ever made, but it was a two-way tie. I started a music school. Now, I cannot play music, but I had a place rented, a room rented, in Dominic Street in Galway, and from 9 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the evening, it was a law practice. And at 4 o'clock in the evening, I hurriedly put away all the legal files, take out keyboards and so on, and it was a music school from about 4:30 until 9 o'clock at night. I'd go into the following morning again and clean up everything to law practice. That's what kept me going. And I went on from there then, and then I got involved in business. And
there's a few things add up and there's a few things don't add up. I can understand getting from commerce to law with some study, but I can't understand going from law to be a music school. Unless somewhere or other you have a musical background and you have the ability or the wherewithal to be able to impart something. Well, while you did mention you recognised you were a facilitator, am I then reading it that you effectively brought musicians in to impart what they had to students?
100%. You're on the button. There's two parts to that answer, though. That's the second part. The first part of the answer is there was only one secondary school in Galway that was teaching music to Leaving Cert. That was the Jes in Galway, an amazing teacher called Carl Heshin. And Carl became a very good friend of mine, and still is. And I said to Carl one day, I said, Carl, why don't we set up a bit of a music school between us? Because I'm sure kids and students from other schools in Galway want to learn music. That to me was the foundation, Austin, of entrepreneurship. Because people often say to me, where do I get an idea for a business? Or give me an idea. No. The way I look at it, where is there a big need? Where is there a big gap? And can you fill that gap? I wasn't able to fill it with my own skill in music because it's not there. What happened then? I went to Carl and I said, Carl, you know musicians who can teach music. So you've answered the second part of it. But the first part has got to do with the business, the entrepreneurship.
Well, we'll come back to you a bit later on and talk to you about your music. You go from music and being a solicitor and your entrepreneurial juices are starting to flow.
What really happened is we had a mortgage on the house. My wife was working. We were getting young kids where kids were coming along. And I wanted to create a situation or an environment where if she felt with it that she wouldn't have to work. And if she wanted to be, and she is very much a family-centered person with the kids if she could. So I said, I'll take on the burden of making enough money if you want to stay at home. I don't want this pressure to be on you. So I worked all hours God give me. And I said, how can I make more money? And I was in my probably early 30s at that stage. And I decided, as a solicitor, I was only getting paid for the hours I work. So if I go on holidays, I'm not getting paid. I said, Jesus, that's not a great way to go, Porrick, is it? How can I make money when I'm not working? So the only way to do that is if I kind of look at starting a business. And there was this little airline flying to the Aran Islands, Austin. And in the media, it was seriously struggling. It was owned by an Irishman who lived in Manchester called Tim Kilroy. And I was saying, geez, there might be an opportunity there. But I had no money. So actually, I found out about Kilroy. I phoned his office, no mobile phones that time. And I said, can I go over and meet him? And in fairness, eventually after he talked to me, he agreed to meet me. I said, I want to buy your airline. He said, how much money do you have? I said, I don't have any. He said, who the hell do you think you are? So anyway, I went back to Ireland and I came up with a great idea. I met a fellow who said, I'd be interested in going in with you in this venture. He knew nothing about airplanes, no more than me, which was a start. And I remortgaged my home. So now I was up to the gills in debt with the banks. Anyway, I went back over to your man and I said, look, I can give you this amount of money. He said, I've been thinking a lot about you since. And if I'm going to sell it to anybody, I'll sell it to you. I said, well, fair play, appreciate it. So the turnover that time was about, this is 1994, was about 200-250 grand a year. And I went to build it up. My partner pulled out just after 9/11. So I was carrying the can at that stage 100%, and that was difficult. But I grew the company from 250,000 in about 8 years to about 130 million a year or 140 million a year. And I couldn't get any money from the banks because they were saying, what do you know about airlines? You've no experience in it. You've no capital behind you. It would be crazy to give you money. And they'd be dead right. If I had money, I wouldn't give it to myself. But when you don't have it and your back is to the wall, there's only one way to go, Austin. Only one way to go. So the company grew very, very, very fast. A lot of the people I could employ at that time, I couldn't employ people from Aer Lingus or Ryanair, a couple of reasons. One, didn't believe I could do what I was trying to do. Secondly, I couldn't afford their salary. Thirdly, they were in a very good, secure, long-term employment where they were. So a lot of the people I employed were outside of that space. And all I wanted to do as, let's call it a leader, was to create the environment in which they could actually learn. Back to the days of teaching. Create the space, create the environment that they could dive in and dip in. And all of a sudden, my vision wasn't my vision anymore. It was their vision. It was they were passionate about it. So together, we built the fastest growing regional airline in Europe at the time. I ended up, I couldn't pronounce, never mind spell it. I won Ireland's Entrepreneur of the Year in 2002 for EY. Represented Ireland, the World Entrepreneur of the Year, finished in the top five in the world. And because of that, I was a judge for the World Entrepreneur of the Year for 2 years afterwards. I chaired the Irish judging panel for, I don't know, 6-7 years or more. And that was that part of it. But that's only half the story.
What you've just described is you were creating an environment for the people around about you where they could develop and have a sense of ownership and a sense of belonging and a sense of security. And the opening of your chapter, your book is Safe Harbor. And there's a bit of a incongruity in what you're describing for others and what you're how you're behaving yourself at that time. And we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But it's just I want to draw attention to it here.
That's a very, very important point. point you make. And please, let's get back to that later. That's really, really important. And to be honest, safe harbor is the core and probably the hub of the book to a large degree. So it's a really important point. But a lot of it depends on how you define your safe harbor. What is your safe harbor? And safe harbor is not exactly the same thing for every person, but we'll get back to that. But then in 2006, I was over in London. These guys wanted me to buy their airline. They're based in the Isle of Man. So I went over to meet them, and I phoned up my wife, and I says, Kathleen, would you come over to London? I've been home for a while, and I've been working all hours God to give me. And we'll go to a show or have dinner or something like that, and we'll come back Sunday evening. And she says, fine. I was Friday, all day Friday, finished the meeting around 2 o'clock in the morning, went up to the room that we were in the hotel, and I couldn't sleep. But anyway, and this is following morning, I woke up, and I wasn't able to eat breakfast. I remember it so clearly. And we decided to go into a subway station. We're going out to Terrace Court or someplace. And I collapsed and I woke up in an ambulance. And I couldn't speak for a number of hours, and they brought me to the hospital. And after I kind of got to and could talk and so on. Do you know, a couple of times in life, are there one or two real turning points in your life? Somebody might have said something or you saw something. This was one of those turning points for me. Kathleen, my wife, who I love totally, said to me, you've got to make a decision. It's either me and the kids or you and the airline. That goes back to safe harbor. What is your real safe harbor? And that kick in the ass was so important. And to me, she had to go that far to get me to cop on. So I then decided to pull out of running the airline. Because you know what they say, Austin? The difference between a pat on the back and a kick in the ass is 6 inches. So when I got out of hospital, I discharged myself, but I said, okay, we'll let you go, provided you go to the hospital in Galway. So I went to the hospital in Galway. I didn't tell my staff or anyone that I was in hospital at the time. When I got out, I started the process of getting a new CEO, somebody to run the company. And I got a guy, a really nice guy, good guy. And he says, Porrick, if you want me to run your company, you got to get the hell out of here, because the staff are going to follow you. And I will not be able to do my job. So, now, he didn't know that I'd been ill, but I really wouldn't say I had no choice, but he was 100% right. So I stepped back. Going on from there, in 2010, we had a recession with a volcanic ash up in Iceland that closed around 25% of the small regional airlines around Europe. Passengers dropped because if somebody was flying to England with you or someplace else, there's no guarantee they were going to get the flight back and all of that. So it was really, really tough. Fuel went through the roof. And Ryanair started in competition with us. I had to make a big decision. And also the big decision was, will I close the company down or what will I do? And I decided to put the company in examinership, which means that basically you prepare a business plan. There are factors outside of your control that causes the issues and not just competition. So there were like recession and so on. And it goes to the courts and the courts accept it. They go through the whole lot in some detail. And then I actually sold some of the shareholding. And this is Shane Austin, I'm telling this warts and all, because I think it might help people reflect a little bit on their life. On the 17th of January, 2012, I had ran the New York Marathon a couple of times, and so I was quite fit. I was running it for Crumlin Hospital for Sick Children in Dublin. On the 17th of January, 2012, I got a heart attack, and my heart stopped. I was clinically dead, according to the doctors. I was on the other side of the fence. The first time they did CPR to get me back. Second time they did they call it jump leads, defibrillator to get me back. And I remember that it felt kind of strange because I knew I was going to die. I felt it on me and I said, am I okay to die? And I said, yeah, I am. But I asked myself two questions. Will my wife and kids be okay afterwards? Yeah, they'd be fine, thank God. Did I give life the best shot I could? Yeah, I gave it the best shot I could, but I made a lot of mistakes. I did stupid things. I did things that were right and good, but then I said to myself, I'm only normal. I'm just like anybody else. I said, God, this part is really important. I don't know if you're a woman or a man. I don't like the idea of, oh, God's a man and so on. Nothing special about men. God may be a man or a woman or whatever. It's what you believe in. It's probably your call, but I'm going to give it my best shot to stay here. So the I was gone. But on the jump leads or the defibrillator, they got me back after a couple of minutes. And then I I decided I started feeling better. So I said, I might be beating this. So I asked, there was a doctor who was doing something on my groin. I didn't know what it was. What they were doing, actually, they put up a camera and then they put up a stent and all that kind of stuff. So, but I didn't know anything about this. I had a full medical done about 4 or 5 months beforehand, and I was told I was in perfect health. So no problem. So, but the cardiologist misread my stuff. So I said to the doctor, Jesus, how are you getting on there? How's it going? He totally ignored me, Austin. And I said, and this is a fact. I said, he probably thinks I sound like Christy Moore. How's the crack? Well, don't go to work without your trouble and stuff like that. So I decided to ask him, what's his name? And he says, my name is Kieran Daly. I said, I'd never met Kieran, but I knew he was a cardiologist. So I said, Kieran, I've been dying to meet you. So he started laughing at me. He says, I'm at this game for 34 or 35 years or whatever. It's the first time ever anyone said that to me in this space. I just felt good about it, Austin. I just felt, geez, I'm getting there. I'm going to see my wife and family again. What this man is doing is working. And afterwards, I was in the kind of post-op room or whatever, and he showed me what happened on the screen and what was wrong and the stent and all that. So I asked him, I said, Jesus, I hope it's an Irish stent. And he says, why are you asking? I said, I hope it's a Galway stent. Because one in every four stents in the world is made in Galway. And the previous year, I was asked to speak to the senior management team in Boston Scientific, and I went in to understand what they do, and then I knew what stents were. Little did I realize that I ended up with one of them. And he says, yeah, Medtronic made it. So I said, would you give me the serial number? He said, yeah, what do you want for it? I said, I want to go over to Medtronic. I want to meet the people who are on the assembly line, who actually made that stent. And I want to thank them, because they're saving people's lives, and I'm one of those people whose lives they saved. And I'm very, very grateful for that. And so a while after, it was probably a month or 2 months afterwards before I was able to go out and do things a little bit, ended up over in Medtronic, and I met them in what I call the clean room. There's about probably 15 to 20 people there. And it was very emotional, very, very emotional. And they came up to me, they had a present for me. And the present was a replica of the exact same stent that's in here, that's keeping me alive, that was manufactured in the same batch as the one that's in there. And I keep that beside me in the locker up in the bedroom, just to realize how fortunate I am, how lucky I am, how blessed I am, and how grateful I am for the life I have. That was, would I call it a turning moment? I don't know. But from my hospital bed, I wasn't supposed to have my mobile phone, but I cajoled my daughter to bring it in. I sold the airline from the hospital bed, more or less. Because Kieran Daly, the doctor, the cardiologist, said to me, people come in here with heart attacks for one or five reasons. It's hereditary. That's not your case. You drink a lot or something, like you don't. You smoke an awful lot. You're very unfit. None of those. Stress. 100% down to stress. So I asked myself, what's giving me that stress? What was giving me the stress was trying to keep the airline going for the sake of the passengers, for the sake of my staff, for the sake of regional Ireland and all of those type of things. But it was getting the better of me. So back to secure base with your family, your wife and family. And there are things you have to give up to help secure your secure base. And that was one of them. And I'm very happy I did that.
So we were talking there about how you established what was your safe harbor. And that's really what are the personal priorities in life rather than what are the business priorities in life. Because I think as you identify very clearly, yeah, you can be a tremendous success in business and have nothing behind it. And you can have a wealth behind life that puts things in a totally different context. So then changing in that, having a radical change in your life in more ways than one. So you got involved in politics.
That was strange. First of all, you mentioned two things there, if you don't mind me just getting, if that's okay. You mentioned success. I think success is a really important word. We, and let's call it the developed world, developed in brackets world, it's all about if you're going to be successful if you get good grades in your exams, if you get good grades in university, if you go lucky enough to go there, if you be a top sports person or something like that. I know a lot of successful people. I know people who were in the Olympics for Ireland. I know people who played international rugby for Ireland. I know some financially wealthy people. There's a big difference, Austin, between success and happiness. We mix those two words up. And I think it's so important to just analyze the difference between the two for each of us. And safe harbor has got to do more with happiness than success. You don't have to have millions and millions and millions of dollars or whatever to be happy. So you don't. Quite frankly, a lot of people who have that, I would argue, mightn't be the happiest people around.
But likewise, Patrick, then it would be a case of that core value system is going to color your whole decision-making process.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's a great point. What are your values? The other thing then has got to do with, I'll be honest with you, your values, which is undermines the foundation of your secure base and the people who are in it, is really important. I remember meeting a very successful businessman years ago, and he asked me, he says, why are you trying to do this? You come from Connemara, there's no aviation experience there. You have no knowledge of aviation, as far as I know you. You're not a wealthy guy. I says, yeah. And he says, why? It's all about money, isn't it? I said to him, it's like this. If you go into a pizzeria, into a restaurant, and you order a pizza, and you look at the menu, and there's a pizza there called money pizza, and there's no slices on it. It's just one big pizza without any five or six or seven slices. And I said, let's call him Michael. Michael, if I go in and I order a pizza called Wealth, same pizza for you, Wealth and Money, same thing for you. And I call one called Wealth. There's five or six different slices on it. The slice called Money with the ingredients for money is totally different to the slice called Health. It's totally different to the slice called Family. Totally different to the slice called Friends. And actually, the base of that pizza, to me, is something called spirituality. And they are the basis of the ingredients for the secure base.
Padraig, I'm going to pause there. We're going to take a musical break.
Okay.
And have you a suggestion?
For music? I do. The Sally Gardens, the Irish reel, because my uncle in New York was my godfather, and he was a great accordion player. And he died. And my mother was very close to him. She's well gone too. And the Sally Gardens was his favourite reel that he used to play.
You're listening to Irish Radio Canada. We're chatting with Patrick O'Cajan. We'll be back with you. Welcome back to At Home Abroad in Irish Radio Canada. We're chatting with Patrick O'Cajan, and we're going to be zoning in on his new book, The Purposeful Decision Maker. And we've been hearing about the importance of having a safe harbor, and that is something that is valuable in your life more than money that you need to protect. And Padraig, just before we went and heard the Sally Garden, mentioned spirituality as being very much at the core of what things are about. Padraig, we grew up in a world where we didn't hear about spirituality, we heard about religion. And there's a big difference, because we were talking about values, and we were talking about how values get changed, and your values change very much when you were literally at death's door. Mm. And you recognize that the money pie isn't made up of a full pie, it's made up of just a slice that enables the other slices in the pie to exist. And how that colored the process that you then went on with for the rest of your life in how you make decisions. Where do you see that in the normal course of events, because in writing a book and putting this out, The Purposeful Decision Maker, there are a lot of books out there telling you how to make decisions. And an awful lot of them are highly analytical, and they're very much draw on your accountancy experience and do the financial evaluation and do the regulatory evaluation and do the market planning and do the business plan and all the other things. But you recognize there's an awful lot more involved in that. That's really all the surface stuff on one level.
Where this came from, Austin, was in the early days of COVID, I got a call from a friend. And one of the things he asked me, he says, what's your projects over COVID? We don't know how long this is going to last. I said, Jesus, I don't know. How do you mean? He said, well, what are you going to spend your time on? Because you cannot be going up and down to Dublin or going out to England or going to America, wherever you go to. He says, you got to find something passionate. He said, why don't you write that book? I said, geez, I don't know how to write a book. So he said, yeah, write a book. Write a book about leadership. There's something I'm passionate about. And I said, I don't know how to write a book. But he says, there's a fellow I know in Galway. This guy had written three books, the guy who phoned me. And he says, he'll act as a mentor for you if I introduce you to him. I said, fine. So he did. And I remember loads of times walking, John Hearn is his name, great guy. I remember walking the prom in Salt Hill. I know you know the prom in Salt Hill. And we meet her like least apart and talking away. And after about three or four sessions, John says to me, Porrick, you're not going to write a book on leadership. I said, John, I don't know what I write it on. Well, he says, the way you're talking to me, he says, you mentioned there the last day to me, What's the single most important word in aviation? I was 26 years in charge of an airline, longer than any other person in Ireland. And there's one word in aviation that's rock solid more than any other word. That word is safety. If you don't have a safe airline, you won't have staff to fly it, you won't have passengers, you have nothing. So safety is number one. Think of Captain Sully landing on the Hudson River. And the reason I'm saying that now, the most important, single most important thing about safety is good decision making. So he says, write a book about decision making. I said, I don't know enough about it. He said, you're 26 years at the crack. That was your focus in the airline. What up to 800 staff? Create the environment which they can make the best decisions they possibly could. So he says, Amazon is wall to wall on leadership. There's far less books there on decision making, particularly practical decision making. So that started taking me down that direction. And I started, Austin, using my 26 years in aviation experience in relation to decision making. Decision making as a lawyer, as a solicitor, decision making as a teacher, decision making as an accountant, decision making, and I used to coach, mentor, I suppose, some Irish Olympic athletes and international rugby players and how they make decisions. And also how decisions are made. You mentioned I was a senator, and you're right, for 4 years or so. How decisions are made there in politics. And I gelled those together and created, put a structure around it to create a process. And then I did a kind of a postgrad in the University of America, and I had access to their library called the Baker Library. And I was able to access the Baker Library and stuff. And I got somebody in to do some research for me to make sure have I got evidence based on this to back it up. And it's a combination of my experience and examples with the evidence based backup to help give people a process or a way for them to kind of challenge their own decision making. And it's not that you won't make bad decisions, you will. But you'll make bad decisions less frequently, or they won't be as bad as they possibly could be. And really, the Purposeful Decision Maker book, it's really a workbook. And it's kept very simple and very straightforward. It's not just purely academic. It's very, very practical. And there's a couple of pages at the end of each chapter for you to write down your own notes on it and to internalize and to interpret it in the world that you're living in relation to how you make decisions and reflect back on decisions you made, some good ones, some not so good ones. Why did they work? Why did they not work? You know, Austin, sometimes we make bad decisions that work out well. Sometimes we make great decisions that don't work out well. So it's really looking at developing the process. As I said, Captain Sully, in landing in the Hudson River, he made a decision very quickly. The people in ground control were telling him to do something else. In many ways, that's the last thing you should be doing because you're not flying that airplane. So on Purposeful Decision Maker, you, the reader, you're flying your own airplane. So shape it in the way that you know best that works for you. And that is the process of the writing in the book for you to bring yourself through this journey to land in a much safer place.
There are three situations that you cover in the book that I want to draw attention to. One is you mentioned when you were a senator, you were made the chair of an interparliamentary group or a cross-party parliamentary group to do an analysis and come up with policy on water charges, which was a highly controversial topic in Ireland to the point of where there were street protests. There was, in some cases, a violent protest, but there was huge, huge, huge resistance. And you were given the wonderful task of achieving some degree of polite debate, consensus, and ultimately coming up with some move forward policy. And you describe wonderfully the process you engaged in and the necessity to be proactive. Do you want to talk a little about that?
First of all, I got a phone call from Simon Coveney. It was about 3 weeks after Ireland played the All Blacks in Soldiers Field in Chicago. I was over at that game. And the return match was on in the Aviva. And he started talking to me about Irish water. I was at home, because I think it was a Thursday night. And I didn't know where he was going. And he says, the supply and confidence agreement between Fine Gael as minority government and Fianna Fáil was that they would set up an Oireachtas joint committee to sort out Irish Water. And he says, Enda Kinney the Taoiseach and Micheál Martin, two people I have a huge respect for. And I'm not a member of a political party, I never was. But I got to know them and they've got, to me, they're really good integrity. As does Simon Coveney. They decided to ask me to go in as chair of this structure. Couple of reasons. One was I've come from a business background and they felt that that would be helpful. The other one was I had no political baggage in any way in relation to it. And I think that they probably trusted me that hopefully I would go through a good process. I was only a wet week in the Shannon. I really didn't know how these committees operate. So actually I set up my own criteria of how they operate. And the first thing I did is that I asked who are the best chair people of Oireachtas committees in the past number of years? And I met three of them. And I said, well, how did you do it? The second thing I did then is I decided to meet every single one of the 19 other members on the committee, all political parties and none. And I sat down with them and I met them twice and three times, some of them, for at least an hour at a time. And I made notes on where they are coming from, what their objective is, how they see it operating, what process do they see in it. When I got all that together then and I put a structure around that, I had a meeting with them in camera. In other words, without the TV cameras there. But normally you have TV cameras switched on at those things. And the reason I did that is I wanted to say to them, I'm giving you guys back the structure that you told me you'd like to have. I want you to sign off on it. And because it was theirs, it was difficult for them to argue against it. So they accepted it. So I said, they're the tram lines or the train lines within which we're going to operate. I'm not going to accept anything that's outside of what we agreed. And that was brilliant because it gave me a process which I could follow, which they had not only bought into, but were part of creating. The next thing I did, we're meeting, say, over a period of 6 months, and we met almost every week. Not necessarily every week, but close enough to it, for in the region of 2.5 to 3.5 or 4 hours at a time. So I mapped out each and every meeting for the next 6 months, and I set on that the primary purpose of each meeting. And I gave that to them, and I said, are you okay with this? Do you want to amend it? Do you want to change it? Do you want to debate that? So we had agreed the agenda for all of the meetings. The other thing I did is I was given the facility where I could have civil servants writing the report. And I said, no, I want to be front and center in writing this report. And after each meeting, my PA and I, we would actually look over a recording of the 3 to 4 hour meeting and say, what were the key elements coming out of this? There were also minutes of the meeting taken by the civil servants who were there at the meetings. But I wanted to have my own thing on it. And that then started forming the basis of the report. It was probably about 50 pages or so long. And then it was debated on and voted on and agreed on and went on from there. And thankfully, it did not cause a general election quickly, which it could have. Thankfully, things have settled down quite a bit in relation to it. And also the huge issue to me, Irish Water was not necessarily about just, let's call it, fixing pipes or making water available to every house. That's obviously critically important. Back to the aviation thing, there's something much more important. The one key word about water for me was health. That was it. People's health. And so what I was aiming for us to do was to create a report or a strategy for government that would improve and enhance people's health in relation to water.
Moving along to another decision you had to make, and that was where you had changed direction, and you are the owner of a number of retirement homes and in County Galway, in Galway region, and someone in Mayo come along and suggests that maybe you'd be interested in taking over their business. And I recall when you did all the business analysis, the HICWA report, the financials, the all the the things that you'd get the accountants to look at and all that kind of good stuff, it all added up.
Yes.
And it added up as a good business decision to proceed. But you didn't proceed.
No. Why? The reason I didn't proceed was back to safe harbor or secure base. Where am I at or what am I, where am I doing? Not only that, but why? So at that time, I was looking at possibly selling the nursing homes, starting another phase of my life, of which the nursing homes wouldn't be part of it. And I saw this couple, lovely people, very genuine people. And the reason they were selling, the why they were selling, is that I think that two of their kids were in Australia, nobody at home. And they wanted to spend time in Australia. And they couldn't do that if they're running a nursing home, which is 24/7, 365. And I was saying, they're dead right. And the penny dropped on me coming back to Connemara from Mayo. And I decided, why? Why am I buying it? It works out financially and all those reasons, but they're all secondary to the purpose. And that's why it's called purposeful decision making. What is the purpose of your decision? What do you really, really, really want? And you've got to decide then back to what you said earlier, Austin, your values. And I remember when I was one of the judges at the World Entrepreneur of the Year, and the chairman of the judges was a Harvard professor of entrepreneurship called Howard Stevenson. And my wife and I became friendly with him and his wife, and he brought us out to dinner one night. And he gave me a signed copy of his book. And he knew entrepreneurship inside out. He'd studied it all over the place and so on. And the name of the book was When Enough is Enough. That's so important for all of us to get that in life. And that book cover flashed in front of my eyes when I started saying why. So that's what happened there.
You're at the end of the book, you relate a story where you were invited to a wedding. And it was a former student. And it was a beautiful way to wrap up, because I think what you're covering in that story is that none of us know when we drop a pebble where the ripples go. And sometimes you can drop a pebble, or it might be a rock, and those ripples can be waves that cause chaos, and other times they can be little gentle ripples that cause people to flourish. Do you want to share a little on that?
Yeah, Austin, that was very special to me. That meant more to me than any awards or recognition or accolades or whatever people thought I should get anyway. And actually, the greatest rewards in life are the ones that are really, really personal. They're not necessarily on the front page of a newspaper or something like that. So I wasn't long teaching. I was a freshman at teaching. And there was this guy at the back who's a big, strong guy. He played rugby. And it was pre-leave insert. And he was doing an arm wrestle with another fella. And all the students were all shouting, come on, Eugene, come on, the other guy, and all that kind of stuff. And I went down. They weren't paying any attention to me and me trying to start correcting homework and stuff. So I went down to the back of the class. I said, come on, guys, I want to start doing some work. I said, no, there's money on this. This is serious stuff. So I wasn't getting any success in it, and maybe I shouldn't have done it, but in hindsight, it was the right thing to do. I didn't think about it. But I was really passionate about getting them to do the maths and do the work. So I said, okay, Eugene, pull up my sleeve. I'll take you on in the arm wrestling. And he says, fine, all the students are all egging him on and so on. And I said, this is the deal. If I beat you, do the best of three. If I beat you, Eugene, you're going to do the same homework and same work, and you're going to study as much as everyone else in the class. You're not going to do any more or any less, but you're going to carry your own piece of work in the class. And if you win, Eugene, you have to stay in the classroom. You're not allowed to interfere with anybody else, but I'm not going to bother you. I'll let you do your own thing. I took him on. Oh, Jesus, almost killed me. He won. He beat me 2-0, I think it was. I said, Jesus, that's that. How stupid can you be as a teacher? And then it dawned on me, oh my, this is going to go all over the school. Be down in the staff room, they'd be saying, what kind of a fool is that guy? And they didn't, nobody really said anything much to me about it. And a long time afterwards, it's probably in November, it was raining heavy. It was, I think, a Thursday or a Friday night. I was driving from Dublin to Galway. And I get a phone call. I usually don't answer phones, numbers from people whose number I don't have. But could I answer this? In a real Galway accent, this one said, are you Patrick O'Cage? I says, I am. Who's this? I'm Eugene. Kind of Galway people, kind of townies, kind of sing their words. And I says, do I know you? He says, of course you know me. He said, how do I know you? You used to teach me long ago in the jazz. I said, don't remember. He said, you do. Remember the arm wrestle? I said, Jesus. He said, what's your address? I said, I'm not giving it to you. Ah, come on, give it to me. What do you want it? He says, I want to send you an invite to my wedding. I'm getting married in a couple of months' time in the Ardilan in Galway. And I'd really like if you and your wife would come along to it. I said, Jesus, that's very kind of you. So I went along to the wedding. There were probably about 120, 130 or so people there. I was sitting down in the back. Actually, Carl Heshen and his wife, the person I mentioned before about music, was there as well. And Eugene stood up and he talked. Thankful for his wife and the family and the usual stuff. And he says, Patrick O'Cage, don't give it up. Will you stand up? I said, Jesus Christ, I must stand up. Go on, stand up. So I stood up, I had to. And he says, look at that man there. But for him, I'd never have got to where I got to. He says, he was the first person ever to believe in me. Patrick, do you remember what I got in Leaving Cert Maths? I says, no, and I didn't. He told me what I got in Leaving Cert Maths. He says, the first time ever in my life that I passed an exam in maths. And now he's got a recording studio, he's got his own business, and so on. That means so much. And I can guarantee you, Austin, that you and listeners, you do make a big difference. Sometimes you don't hear, more often than not, you don't hear it back. More often than not, you don't hear it back. But we all do make a difference. We all make a really, really positive difference. And long may we continue.
And you do have a chapter in there which ties in with that, and that is using your gut. Because, you know, the gut is the thing that, as we said with the nursing home, as we said with so many other things, everything adds up. But something's niggling at you, and or it's something is unconventional, or you go approach it in a different way, as you did with Eugene. And that's not the kind of thing, again, you're normally going to find between the covers of a book on decision-making.
No. And gut feeling is so important. Gut feeling is instinct. It's actually getting a sense of particularly other people and other situations and environments. And you have to decide, which way am I going to go, or what am I going to do in this situation? And you get this sense or feeling that, yeah, I'm right to go. I don't know where I'm going to get to, but I'm right to go in this direction. And gut is very much a human instinct. It's not a mathematical accounting or a legal thing or something like that. It's what you sense and feel in the environment around you and the energy, which you cannot see, you get from other people. And actually, the safe harbor, it's very important because sometimes your safe harbor, and I'm going to ask you and ask your listeners, will you get a sheet of blank A4, whatever size paper, and get a pen and draw a circle on that. And write in the middle, start writing down the initials of the people who are in your safe harbor. And start going out to the edge of, excuse me, and they could be family, they could be friends, they could be people you work with. And then ask yourself about each one of those. Do they give me energy or take energy from me? Why are they in there? The question why again. And you know, if you look back on it, sometimes if you look on your safe harbor when you were 5 years of old to 10 to 20 to 30 to 40 and so on, you see that it changes a little bit. And it might be important for it to change. Because sometimes people who are in your safe harbor, it runs its course. and you're better off, and they're better off, without you being in their safe harbour or they've been in your safe harbour. So it's really, and that's core to decision making. And what strengthens your safe harbour? Finances are important. I'm not saying they're not. They're very important because that starts giving you security again. But the most important thing are the people who are in it. The people who give you energy, who energize you. And if somebody energizes you, I can guarantee you, you energize them back. Because energy works both ways. So it does. It works both ways. So, and gut feeling will give you a strong sense of the direction of that energy. Is that energy coming or going? Does the energy of both of us connecting together increase the overall energy or decrease it? So, yeah, to me, gut feeling is very, very important.
We're going to talk about one more thing, but before we do, we're going to advise that the book is available as in from the 12th of November. You can get it on, it'll be available on Amazon, and it's available on a variety of other platforms. It is The Purposeful Decision Maker, A Guide to Making Great Decisions in Life and Business, and it's Padraig O'Cage is the author. But Padraig, I want to bring you back to something we were talking about earlier on, and that's music. You're getting involved in a project. Do you want to tell us what the goals, the objectives are?
Okay. Well, the purpose of the project, going back to purposeful decision making, the primary purpose of it is to that a charity in the west of Ireland called Cancer Care West, a brilliant charity, can raise money for them and the great work they do for people all over the west of Ireland, Donegal down to Limerick, and all over Galway and Offaly and Roscommon and that. And that's the purpose of it. So I came up with this idea. I was practicing, I was in with my teacher, Fiber, a number of us in there, and I was banging away on the ballroom learning class, and I said, Jesus, isn't that a great idea? And I asked the teacher, how many students does he have? And he has over 300 students. I said, that's interesting. Sorry, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. So I decided, came up with an idea that I would love that we would do an attempt at the world record of ballroom players in Galway, Air Square, St. Patrick's Day. Excuse me, next, in 2025, and we're doing that.
And is there a record in place at the moment anywhere, and is there a number that you're trying to beat?
There is. Actually, in Australia, in Sydney, I think it was 2014, they had 940 ballroom players. We're looking for 1,500 ballroom players to be in Air Square, and actually we're going to do it on Sunday, the 16th of March. I've been talking to guards, Galway City Council, who actually are in charge of the parade. They're all over it. They really love it. I've obviously been charged talking to Cancer Care West. We're looking at getting bow runs in for people who don't have them. We're going to have classes online for people to learn the bow runs. We'll have a warm-up session for probably about 45 minutes beforehand, and then we'll go full into it. And we're asking people to donate €100 if they can, or $100, directly to Cancer Care West. They'll get an official receipt. And we also plan to give an official certificate to everyone who participates to say, Austin, you were one of the 1,500 people that achieved the World Book of Records in relation to ballroom playing in Galway on the 16th of March, 2025. Plus also we're talking to Fáilte Ireland and Tourism Ireland and so on. So when people come and stay in the Galway region, and if they want to just play the ballroom for the crack and be with us, they're more than welcome to do so. So, but the primary purpose is to raise much needed funds for Cancer Care West to help people who need help during their time of going through an illness like that. That's the primary purpose of it.
Well, I was going to ask you for another piece of music, but I'm going to propose a piece.
Great, do that.
Because it's a Bowron solo.
Oh, wow. Who's playing it?
Christy Moore, St. Patrick was a gentleman.
That's brilliant. I have to look up that. I've got to get that. That's fantastic.
So, Patrick O'Cage, it's been fun, wonderful, great chatting with you, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, Austin, I really appreciate meeting you, talking to you. I really hope this is the start of a friendship and we'll meet each other again, I'm sure. And to all your listeners, thank you so much for listening. And I wish you well. I wish you a really happy, successful, safe harbour. God bless you all. Slán.